Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, and welcome back. I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and that long-winded title simply means I'm your garden information translator. I read all the articles in the Plant Soil Science journals and then translate them so you can use the information in your garden to save time, money, and natural resources. Each week, I'll try to stretch your mind a little bit, and sometimes my own, by looking at the very newest plant science and see how it might change some of our ideas about what the best way to manage our gardens is. And each week, I try to follow some kind of theme. Today's theme is waterworks. We're also going to head outside to chat with me. I thought I'd take you on a virtual tour of my garden, looking at how things have changed in the 11 years since we've been here. But first, let's look at water in the news. My first news item is from ScienceDaily.com, and the title is Using Less Water to Grow More Potatoes. Sounds like an oxymoron. Sounds like how could you possibly use less of a resource and get more out of it? Well, here's where the myth information hits the facts. About 100 years ago, actually more than 100 years ago, farmers started producing potatoes in Idaho. The way that farmers planted their potatoes was to plant them in ridges and then create a channel in between the ridges for watering. And that was because this is long before sprinklers were invented, and the way they used to water these crops was by flood irrigation. So they had canals that ran all over the landscape, and they would open up a gate to the canal, flood the landscape, the water would go through these rows, and then water the potatoes. And it was a good system. Then they went to sprinkler systems, and still kept the same type of setup, still having these ridges, still with the channels in between. But it turns out that this particular setup means you get a lot more runoff because the soil is not mulched, it's bare soil, water hits the surface, it goes to the lowest point, which are those ridges. So it would run off, it would percolate sometimes below where the potato roots were, and not only did the water then miss the roots, so did a lot of the fertilizer. And they were finding they had a lot of runoff of nitrates and water from this particular system. So recently, some research has shown that planting potatoes on flat fields actually works better. And this was a big research project that went over a number of years in a number of different places. And what they found was using a flat bed system, in other words, planting potatoes without a canal running down the middle, managed to use less water, about 5% less water, and increased yield by 6%. And what that translates to is actually an overall 11 or 12% increase in water use efficiency. That's just a fancy way of saying that they got more potatoes for less water. So obviously spending money more efficiently. So how does this translate to your garden? Well, if you're like a lot of people that plant a potato patch or two, you might plant a mound. And this is the way people do it. They do little hills and they have the potato at the top of that hill. And it sounds like you might be able to save yourself some water and fertilizer loss by just planting it at grade and going ahead and watering it just like you do the rest of your garden. My second item is from gardenprofessors.com. Since it's still summer here and actually getting hotter than it was for the earlier part of our summer, I thought it was appropriate to talk about wilting and droopy leaves. And there's a little bit of misinformation running around the internet talking about droopy leaves not really meaning that plants need water. But the conventional wisdom here is that when plants get droopy leaves, it means they're conserving water. And if you add more water, it's actually going to hurt them because you'll add all this water, it'll take up all the air space in the root zone, and the roots won't get enough oxygen, and then you actually hurt your plants. So it kind of sounds logical, and then the advice is you wait until nighttime, and if the plants haven't perked back up, you give them a little water then. So this is one of those little myths that is really kind of aggravating to me as an educator, because there's a little kernel of truth to it, but the assumption behind it is actually wrong. There are some plants that are really adept at conserving water in hot weather, and you're familiar with some of these. You may use them in your garden. They tend to have kind of a dusty color to their leaves. It might be a gray-green or a gray-blue, and that just means that they have a lot of wax on the surface of their leaves that helps keep them from losing water. So things like heathers and rosemaries and things that have kind of that dusky color tend to be water conservers. Their leaves are also pretty small. They may be thick. They may be needle-shaped. Anyway, they just have a good shape and covering to conserve water. And these particular leaves, sure, you know, they don't tend to droop very often because they don't lose water very easily. But if you think about a lot of the plants you might grow in your vegetable garden or as cut flowers, they may tend to have big floppy leaves. Think about sunflowers, for instance, or lettuce, or some of these things with very large, thin leaves. These are not water-conserving plants. These leaves have a large surface area. Water can evaporate out very quickly. And the problem is if you don't replenish water once that wilt starts, you get what's called terminal wilt. And terminal wilt is exactly that. It's terminal. So once it's that far wilted, the plant can't take up water to replace the water in those leaves, and the leaves die. So ignoring wilt can lead to this terminal wilt problem. And so you don't want to have that happen. What you want to do is add water as soon as the plant is telling you it needs water. You don't want to wait till nighttime. While it is best to irrigate early in the morning or sometimes in the evening, anytime you see your plants wilting means it's evaporating more water than it can take up, and it's a good idea to put some more water back there in the root zone. If this happens a lot to you in your garden, you see things that are wilting all the time and you have to give them water all the time, there's some ways you can correct this problem. It may be that you've planted that particular species someplace that's too hot. If it's on the south side of a house, think about moving it to the east side or the west side, or maybe even the north, someplace where it's not nearly as warm. You may have too many plants that are planted in the same area. So think about moving them around a little bit. Give them a little bit more leg room so that they don't compete with each other so much. Or it might be they just haven't established their roots yet. If it's a new plant, then if it's been transplanted relatively recently, you'll find that it's going to need more water for those roots as they're getting established. So what you want to do is, yes, water your plants when they tell you you're thirsty. It's the same as you. If you were thirsty in the middle of the day, would you wait until evening to take a drink of water? Well, of course not. You would take a drink of water when you needed it. And your plants are telling you the same thing. One of the unintended functions of my very own landscape is I use it as a living laboratory. Now, this isn't a scientifically rigorous setup, of course, but it gives me some good anecdotal evidence for further exploration, whether by me or somebody else doing research. So today I thought I'd take you on a tour of my garden to see what's happened over the last 11 years. So we'll look at some things that worked well, some things that maybe didn't work so well, and some ideas that might help you in your own garden.
One thing that occurred to me is that even though I've talked about my garden quite a bit, I haven't really taken you outside to see much of it other than our pond when I interviewed my husband about the pond that he installed. So I thought what I'd do on this last podcast of our first season is take you through some other parts of my garden to explain some successes, some failures, and what's been going on in the last 11 years here. So right now I'm in the front yard, and you've seen pictures of this before. It has a pond. There's no turf here at all, surrounded by a fence for some privacy. And when we first moved here, all it was a lawn with a few trees and shrubs. There were actually two driveways because there's two garages. And one of these driveways we actually pried out with a pry bar, got rid of all the asphalt, and then planted it. So now it doesn't look like a duplex anymore. It looks like a real house. And the plants that are here are things that were from other parts of the yard or were new plants. And some of the ones I want to look at today are the ones that we moved from other parts of the yard, because this can really help you if you've got some plants that perhaps aren't performing very well. So over by the front door, I have three big containers, and each container has a rose bush in it. My husband is not a fan of roses, unfortunately, but he tolerates the fact that I like to have roses out here in our sunny south-facing spot, and I can cut flowers and bring them inside. Well, all three of these roses used to be on the other side of our house, which I'll take you to someday, and in the shade all day long, and had mummy flowers. That's all you ever got. The buds would start to expand, and then it would get moist and rainy, and then you'd have mummy flowers. We were going to redo the backyard anyway, and one of the things I decided to do was not get rid of the roses, but just move them. So I dug them up, put them in these big containers, brought them around to the front side of the house facing south, and now I've got three rose bushes, never a mummy flower in the years and years I've been here. They love the sun, the moist conditions that cause that mummy flower fungus to infect the buds is just not able to tolerate the heat and the sunlight. So all of a sudden we've got the right plant in the right place. Next to my area with roses is a row of Daphne. These were ones that we brought with us from our other house and transplanted. And they have also loved it here. They like the heat, and they have just filled the air with fragrance nearly all year long. But in the last year or so, they've started to decline, and one of them is actually dead now. You hear rumors that Daphnes don't have very long lives sometimes, and some people just say, yeah, they only last a few years, maybe a few decades, and then they are just going to die and need to be taken out. I don't think that's necessarily true, but we have had some odd weather here in the last few years that I think has contributed to the death of these Daphnes. So what's happened is that the normally green leaves have started to turn yellow, and then a week or so later they're just completely dried up. So you prune off those branches, and then you see it someplace else and someplace else, and you prune and prune, and eventually I started to get down to the trunk where I found a lot of splitting. So the trunk had split, the wood had died, and I think what happened was in these last few winters where we had a cold spell very early in the season that they just weren't cold hardy enough to tolerate the freezing temperatures. Even though this is a south-facing landscape right here, it is at the bottom of a hill, and cold air just pours down this hill and piles up at the bottom, which is right at our front door. So we have a south-facing exposure, but it gets very cold because of all the air coming down that hill. And I think the Daphnes just got too much cold too fast the last year or two, and that's what's happened. That's caused the water inside the trunks to freeze, and that's what causes the splitting. So I'll probably be taking all three of these guys out. One's already dead. The other two I'll probably just kind of baby along, see if I can get part of them to come back. Otherwise, I guess they'll be leaving for plant heaven, and I'll have to bring in something else that's nice, compact, and fragrant like these plants have been. Walking down a little bit farther past the Daphnes, we get to more or less the end of the front yard up here by the fence. And we've got two rhododendrons here, and on one side we've got a blue hydrangea, and then there's a couple smaller rhododendrons in the front. The two bigger rhododendrons used to be crammed up together along the side of this fence, and as they got bigger, they were really out-competing each other. And so I dug them up and replanted them farther apart so they had a little bit more room to spread, and then moved a hydrangea that was in the backyard into the front yard. Now, one of the things about this hydrangea is that it is a very thirsty plant, and now that it's in a south-facing location, we've had to keep it especially well-watered. It tends to be the one that gets thirstiest the fastest. But it's a great addition out here. It more or less keeps in the place that we put it. It's not going to get much bigger. And the rhododendrons, on the other hand, are able to spread out. We had a bit of a disaster a few winters ago when one of the trunks from the arborvitae hedge that's in the background of these rhododendrons bent over with excess snow and ice and actually crushed this one rhododendron, taking most of it out. But the neat thing about rhododendrons is that they're one of these shrubs that's pretty tolerant of being pruned pretty much to the ground. And so if you have a shrub like this that's been damaged and beyond repair, it's best just to try to take it all the way down as far as you can, give it some decent trunks to start resprouting from, and then see what happens. Worst case scenario, you have to take it out completely the following year, but maybe it'll be just like this one and start to come back. I've actually done a lot of pruning to the ground with rhododendrons, and in every case, they've come back quite strongly, and I've been able to shape them to a good form and enjoy them as shrubs in a few years. This one now is probably close to 6 feet tall, and it's grown 2 or 3 feet in the last year, so it's starting to look like a real rhododendron again. So when you get that damage to some of these plants, don't despair. Don't think that it's all over. Give it a chance. Prune it back hard and see what you can get the following year. One of my favorite plants that I've got out here in the front yard is actually a very vigorous ground cover. It's called Blue Star Creeper. It's not hardy enough to grow in some parts of the country, but it does very well in our climate. And it's one of those things that just covers a multitude of sins. It does like nice bright sunlight, so out here in our front yard facing south, of course, it does quite well. It's filled in the gaps between our paving stones, which is nice. It's actually crawled over the rocks around our ponds and grown in between the rocks, helping hold them in place. It flowers almost all summer long, and I'm watching it right now, and there's all kinds of honeybees that are visiting the flowers, so it provides a pretty constant source of nectar for them. And where it doesn't grow, which is usually a shadier area, the other ground covers manage to come in and fill in those gaps. One of my favorites is the shade-loving ground cover out here is Oregon oxalis. So it looks like a shamrock leaf, but it's not the weedy kind of oxalis. It's actually a native plant. it doesn't do well in sunlight, but it does very well in the shade. So what you should try to do when you're doing ground covers is let them kind of duke it out. Plant lots of different kinds. They'll grow best wherever they grow best, and where they meet, they'll fight. And whichever one grows better in that area wins. And so you end up having a patchwork of ground covers. It makes it easier to keep landscape weed free, and it's much more interesting than just having one kind of ground cover. The last plant I'm going to mention that's in our front yard is actually one of the few survivors of the trees that were here when we moved in that we didn't either eliminate or adopt out to somebody else. And it's a lace-leaf Japanese maple. It's a red cultivar, so it's got that kind of that blood red color. And it used to be in a different part of our yard, and it turned out that there was a water leak, not on our side of the pipe, but on the city side, and they gave us, I think, exactly one day's notice that they were to come and dig up the landscape to fix the leak. And of course, this tree was right over the leak. We weren't very happy to hear this, of course, because the plan would have been to just backhoe the tree out of there, and it's a nice tree. So my husband and I quickly got out the shovels and the tarp and dug the thing up and moved it. I think this may have been in March or so when we had to move this, so it's not a great time to transplant, but at least it's not the same as midsummer. And we just took out as much of the root mass as we could, and this is always what people ask, is how much of the roots should we take out? And the answer is as much as you can. The more roots you can save, the easier it is for them to transplant and establish. It's harder to move, of course, but it's better for the plant. So we had a tarp, got the thing on there, drug it across, put it in its new location, got it planted, mulched well, kept it watered, and it's established very nicely. And it turns out to be in a better location anyway, given where we decided to put the pond. So it has been a successful transplant, and I would always encourage you, if you've got a situation where a tree that you love is in danger of being eliminated by some kind of activity, give it a shot. Try to transplant it. Wait until the cooler seasons to do that. But it's worth trying. All that can happen is it can die, but if you don't transplant it, it most surely would.
We've included some pictures of my landscape over the last 11 years at the Garden Professor's website, and that's gardenprofessors.com. So every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of our show. Questions about how water works, in other words, how water moves through plants, how it moves through the soil, are really common questions. And even though plants need water, there is a problem with too much of a good thing. So this leads to one of the most common myths in gardening lore, and this is the myth of drainage material in containers. So the lore goes, you want to add a layer of gravel or other coarse material to the bottom of your containers before you plant to improve drainage, because plants don't like wet feet. And you can look through a number of books and websites on container gardening, and nearly all of them recommend placing some kind of coarse material at the bottom for this very reason. It could be sand, it could be pot shards, it could be pebbles. And let me tell you, when I was getting my PhD, that I did all this stuff with my container plants because that's what the book said to do. And a lot of these recommendations are really scientific sounding. And this is what's tricky about some of these recommendations that aren't necessarily scientific. Here's one from a 1960s book on container plants. Adequate drainage is secured by covering the hole in the bottom of the pot with a piece of broken flower pot, concave side down. This in turn is covered with a layer 1/2 to 1 inch deep of flower pot chips. On top of this, a 1/4 inch to 3/8 inch layer of coarse organic material, such as flaky leaf mold, is placed. Now, when you hear that, you think, wow, it's really specific. You've got, you know, inches, and you've got concave, and you've got secured, and you have all these words that sound really scientific and official. It's just very precise. It's a recipe, and we know how much we like to follow recipes. And if you think about it, plants do need good drainage, and it kind of makes sense that if you have bigger things at the bottom of a pot, that water will move through that faster. Well, this is where you have to really challenge yourself, and this was one of the hardest myths for me to mentally overcome because it just didn't make sense at first. But there was some research done over 100 years ago by soil scientists actually at Washington State University that showed that water does not move easily from layers of one type of texture, soil perhaps, to another texture, in this case maybe gravel or pot shards. So you'll have to visualize here having a cutaway section of some soil on top of some pot shards or gravel or sand or anything. It's different. And you pour water through, and what happens is the water moves through very easily, whether it's a clayish soil or a sandy soil, until it hits that interface. And the interface is where one type of material touches the next. And this is where the weird part starts. The water then stops moving downward, and it starts moving horizontally. So instead of moving down as you'd expect, it goes horizontally until that whole upper layer is completely saturated with water. And then because the weight of the water is so much, it pushes through into that next layer and water starts to trickle through that next layer. So what you've created, if you think about this, if you've created a bathtub, you've made the soil super saturated, and it isn't until it's so heavy and soggy that the water actually starts moving out of it. And this is what happens, whether it's pot shards, whether it's gravel, whether it's sand, anything. And you can all actually prove this to yourself. I stole this idea actually from Joe Lample, who does Growing a Greener World. And he does a demonstration where you take a sponge and you fill it with water, you know, just pour water on top of it. And you know that the water doesn't just run out the bottom of the sponge. It hydrates until the sponge is so completely saturated it finally starts dripping out. So the point of this is that water just doesn't move easily from different textures. It moves very easily when things are the same, but when the pore size, and that's the space between things, whether it's between pieces of gravel or pieces of soil or parts of a sponge or air, is different, then you just have that problem where water doesn't move through easily. So it's a really interesting myth, because the myth really was built to help increase drainage, and actually if you follow the directions, it does exactly the opposite. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. That's my official WSU webpage, and it's full of free and great information. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. It concludes the first season of podcasts of The Informed Gardener. We're going to be taking a break for about a month to prepare for the next 8 episodes. In the meantime, you can listen to the archive podcasts found at theinformedgardener.com.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, as well as other stories and articles she's written, please visit informedgardener.com, gardenprofessors.com, or sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. Thank you to Large Media, executive producer and production direction, and the WSU faculty and staff. Happy gardening!